The Dirty Dozen, Ireland's motorsport legends in conversation with John Kenny. This week, Eddie Irvine.
And Eddie Irvine now comes through the cross complex and back out onto the main straight. It's victory for Ferrari, victory for Eddie Irvine, victory for Ireland at the Australian Grand Prix. So what a wonderful afternoon in Australia. Look at all the tricolours being waved there for this wonderful achievement.
Eddie Irvine winning the Australian Grand Prix in 1999. A season in which he very nearly became Ireland's only Formula One champion when his Ferrari came second to Mika Hakkinen. His F1 career began with a smack in the mouth from Ayrton Senna, and his colourful career brought much comment and controversy. Amongst other things, he now runs and owns Cocoon, a fashionable bar in Dublin, where we met, and he first brought me back to his childhood living near Bangor in County Down.
It was just totally normal. There was no issue. We would, you know, go out and play. Bangor wasn't, you know, I was living in a country between Bangor and Nord, so it was not an issue. You know, the most exciting thing that happened to us in Bangor was blown up by an incendiary bomb, and all the fire damaged stuff was dumped near my house, so we went up there and had more rubbers and pencils and pens and all sorts of stuff for school.
Was it an exciting time for you to be living where you lived?
I loved it. We were in the middle of the countryside. There was foxes and badgers, and it was right beside Lord Dufferin's estate, so there was deer, and I went poaching for the brown trout in his lake, and there was a golf course right beside the house.
Where did you start racing? Was it the old reliable route? Did you come through karting?
No, I started Formula Ford. I used to go to Kirkuston when I was late 16s. My father and me, we spotted this Crosley. Like it was £800 or something, or £1,200, I can't remember. And we had a Capri that we'd bought for £800. And we painted it and polished it all up, and we swapped it for this Crosley, and we went motor racing for a laugh.
And was your family funding your racing? Did you get any sponsors?
Oh, you didn't need it. It cost, the way we did it cost nothing. You know, we just took it down the trailer. You'd one engine build a year, and we were using like 3-year-old tyres, so it was didn't cost anything. The entry fee was the most expensive thing, and the petrol.
And you raced in Formula Ford. Your big year, though, when you decided to, I suppose, take it much more serious, was 87, when you won the British Championship, the Esso Series, the RAC, and then the Formula Ford Festival as well. First, tell us about the British Championship, that whole season, that 1987 season.
Well, I was very lucky because I had made the sort of, at the end of 86, I was going to give it up because I was buying and selling cars and I was doing very well doing that, and I was paying for my racing out of my car dealing, and I had an old Van Diemen and I was racing that, and at the beginning it went very well, and all of a sudden I went off the pace, but at the beginning it had gone very, very well. You know, I got the fastest lap in a British Championship race driving a year-old car. That surprised me, you know, because I thought I was okay, but I didn't think I was that good. And then at the end of the year, Ralph Furman asked me to come and test drive the works car, and I went very well, and that then, I got into the works Van Diemen and won everything. And you know, I nearly lost the Esso Championship because I was concentrating on the RAC, which is the big championship, and I missed a few rounds of the Esso and I had a few accidents, but I won it as well. And then the Formula Ford Festival led every lap. I just had to make the only thing I had to do, because I was the fastest, I just had to make the start, and I've always been good at starts, so I was okay.
How did you feel about winning that at the time? I mean, how big a deal was it for you?
Well, I could only lose it. I can't remember how many races that year. I'd done 30-something races. I'd been on pole position 29 times. I'd only not been on pole like 5 or 6 times. I basically won every race I finished. And the Formula Ford Festival was the big one. Like, not to have won that would have really hurt me big time. Probably not career-wise, but it would have really hurt me personally, because I loved the Formula Ford Festival was the race. And to win it, that was just mega. I could only lose it, really. And it was just a massive relief to win it.
And looking back on your career that's followed since, how big an influence was winning those championships and the Formula Ford Festival itself?
Well, that was the year that Marlborough picked me up. You know, I'd done in the middle of that year, Marlborough had started this staircase of talent, and I was at that time winning everything. And actually, I wasn't picked initially for some reason, because I thought I was a bit old there was something weird. And, you know, they wanted me to drive on a certain day, and I couldn't drive on that day because I was testing. Anyway, I went into a Formula 3 car instead of a Formula Ford 2000, so I jumped ahead, really, and it was more of a big step looking at it then, because I remember saying to them, I want to do Formula Ford 2000, I want to do 2000, Formula 3 is too much of a step. And they said, no, we want you to do the Formula 3, and I get in, and I was quicker than Blundell, who had driven a season of Formula 3, quicker than all the other guys had done Formula 4 2000, which was quite close to Formula 3. So that surprised me, and I got the drive.
Ralph Firman seems to have been a big influence on a lot of drivers around that time. Yourself, Derek Daly, a lot of people have been backed by Ralph Firman.
Ralph was brilliant, you know, because at the start of the season I was really, really quick. I was on pole for every race, but, you know, I was a marked man, you know, and I just got involved in accidents. And I never won one of the first five races or something. There was always something happened, you know, and then Ralph says, just don't worry about it. You're the quickest. There's nothing to do. Just go out there and you're going to win the race. And I just, then it just started boom, 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 boom. It was one win after another, after another, after another. And, you know, Ralph was, he's a very cool character, you know, he's very laid back. Now, Ralph is a real star, and he loves motor racing. He's still involved in motor racing. He sold Van Diemen now, but he loves motor racing, and that's the sort of people that should be in motor racing.
But he did have a real grow for Irish drivers, though, didn't he?
Well, his wife, Angie, was Irish, you know, so I guess there was that. And Tommy Byrne, he was in love with Tommy Byrne. He'd probably seen a little bit of Tommy Byrne in me or whatever. Probably a more controlled version of Tommy Byrne.
Now, that 88 season is when you went from Formula 1600 to Formula 3. You were fifth overall in the championship, but they won Macau that year. And Macau is, I suppose, the Formula 3 version of the Formula Ford Festival.
I had a good car, but we had the Alfa Romeo engine, and, you know, it just didn't have pickup out of corners. It was the top end was very good. It didn't have torque, and Formula 3 was all about torque coming out of corners. We just couldn't do anything. And then we went to Macau, which had higher fuel spec. I put it on pole. I won the first heat. I set the lap record. And in the second heat, I didn't make the best start. And Ricard and Rydell and me came together, and that was it. It was all over. But I would have won it quite easily, which was fantastic. The Malibu guy said, look, qualify well, and you'll be stepping up to 3,000. Because they kind of believed that my engine wasn't that good. Anyways, they said to me, do the best job you can do in qualifying, and, you know, if you do well, you'll be in Formula 3000. Anyway, I put it on pole, so I thought, I can't do much better than that.
But you are making, at this stage, the natural progression. It doesn't happen so much, I suppose, these days, with the amount of money around that younger drivers can buy themselves into Formula 1. But you're doing the Formula Ford 1600s, as you say, into F3, now into F3000.
Yeah, well, that's the way it should be. Senna, for me, had kind of the perfect career in a way. You know, he went Formula Ford 1600, he won a championship. Formula Ford 2000, he won a championship. Formula 3, he won a championship. And then the Formula 1. The Formula 1 step was a bit too big, really, in them days. But it was that, for me, was the beautiful career, you know. Formula 3000 then went in above Formula 3. And that was then, there was maybe a few too many steps. Formula Ford 2000 disappeared. So maybe Formula Ford, Formula 3... GP2 is what it's called now. Formula 1 is kind of, for me, is probably the way it should be, and they should get rid of all this other bullshit.
It's like learning a trade, isn't it?
Yeah, they should get rid of all this other stuff that's going on, because you've too many, at least you've got all the guys competing together. Now you've got Renault doing their little thing, you've got Nissan doing their little thing, you've got these guys, and they should be told, no, you can't do it. If you want to do it, you sponsor a driver. You know, so all the drivers are in each series. You know, but it's the FIA that's, it's not the best run organisation in the world, I don't think.
And you had a stint with Eddie Jordan for the first time in 1990. How was that?
It was a bit of a disaster in a way. It was good in one way, it was a disaster in another way, because they'd won a championship the previous year with Alessi, but they were going Formula 1 the following year, so EJ basically raped the Formula 3 budget and put it into his Formula 1 team, and it showed. I won one race. I beat the Italian Formula 3 champion, and I beat the German Formula 3 champion in the same car that year, but we were nowhere. I think I finished third in the championship or something, but that got me the opportunity to go to Japan.
Was Formula 1 knocking before you top at that sideways move to Japan?
I went for a test with Onyx, but they didn't even give me new tyres at a place like Paul Ricard, which is probably the hardest circuit in the world on tyres. So, but the team didn't want me there. They were kind of forced. I was forced on them by Marlborough. There was a change of the guard in the team, and they didn't want me, and they didn't give me any tyres, and it was looking back, I shouldn't have done it, but any chance, you know, I was naive at that stage. I just wanted to get into Formula 1. Marlborough were looking after me, and I didn't realise the politics in the team.
What about Japan? How did that come about?
Raced the end of the season in the Asian Cup or whatever it's called in Macau, and then And then Japan, they finished third in both races, which is good considering I was stepping down, because a Formula 3 car, after a Formula 3000 car, feels like it's like driving a ladder. You know, it's you just can't feel it. There's no grip, there's no power. It's a weird feeling, but I was happy enough with that. And a Japanese team approached me and said, "Do you want to come here?" And I said, "Yeah, why not?" They offered me $60,000, $80,000, something like that, and prize money. There was no option to go to Formula 1, you know, so I thought I need to get paid. There's no point at a European 3000 again. So I went to Japan.
Yeah, and you were there for 3 years as well.
Yep. Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I had such a blast. Tokyo, I love Tokyo. You know, it's just such a fun city. And I ended up being the highest paid driver in Japan very quickly. And I had a great team I love working with. We missed the we actually won the championship, but we lost it. We scored the most points, but we had to drop a score, and we were equal with the guy that was second, and then he won because he had one more race or something. So even though I had the most points, I lost. But I just had a blast there. I loved it.
Yeah, there was talk that when Eddie Jordan came calling again to go to Formula One that you weren't particularly pushed.
Well, I wasn't, because for the following year, I had like $1.3 million worth of contracts in my bag, and then I had prize money and all that stuff to go on top of it, and, you know, little side deals. So, and Formula One... You know, Damon Hill was in a Williams, and all the guys that we raced, all the guys in that era, none of them reckoned Damon Hill. I remember Marco Appicello says, if Damon Hill wins a race in Formula One, I'm retiring, you know? Because Damon was a bit of a joke in a way, and he was in a Williams, and I had no respect for Formula One really at that stage, because I realised there was too much about the car, too much about politics. In Japan, we had qualifying tyres, our teams looked after us like gods, and we were making good money, and you know, EJ was offering me 120 grand or something.
So why did you go then to Formula One?
A lot of it was I was in Barbados with my father, and I could see how much he wanted me to go to Formula One. He was like, you know, when you get into motorsport, you start realising the politics, and you start realising that drivers I had no respect for at all were racing in Formula One and doing well in Formula One. And I didn't see it the way I seen it before. So, and then to have had that opportunity and not have done it would have really... It was a bad decision on my part, put it like that. His passion for it was definitely the right way to go.
Well, what a start. I mean, that was the Japanese Grand Prix that you raced in, and you knew Japan, that circuit, very well, of course. And you unlapped yourself against Senna. I mean, it's still talked about that day. And you also picked up your first points in your first Grand Prix. So it was an eventful day, right? And he came around to the caravan and smacked you one.
Yeah, but when I think about that Grand Prix, I don't think about the Senna punch. I don't think about qualifying it. I remember the first corner. I was eighth on the grid, and I drove around the outside of three people at the second corner. I went around the outside of Michael Schumacher and two other guys, and I'm in fifth. I remember this, to say I'm in fifth position. I could see Senna, I could see Prost, and I'm right up their gearbox in a way, you know. I'm only 2 cars behind these two guys, and I think I had I can't remember who it was, but I remember going around the outside of Schumacher, and I was laughing. I was thinking, what a bunch of wankers letting me do that. You know, I'm in a Jordan that hasn't scored any points. I'm in fifth position in my first Grand Prix. And then I really remember, like, it started to rain, and I radioed telling them I'm coming in, and they said, no, keep going. And I went around another lap, and that cost me an extra 1 or 2 points. So that's what I think about, because I analyse things to see how I could have done better. The result of sixth means it was good because I scored a point, and Prost and I think Alessi, the only two guys had done it before, so it was good from that point of view. But I was really pissed off that I hadn't scored an extra two, because I should have done.
Were you surprised when Senna approached you after the race?
Yeah, totally, because he was totally picking on the wrong guy. It was Damon Hill caused the whole thing. Damon wouldn't let him pass. I let him pass initially, and then Damon wouldn't let him pass, and Damon was totally in the wrong. And then when Damon was holding him up, I'm thinking, I'm racing Damon, I can't sit here all day. So I overtook Senna, and then I overtook Damon. You know, and it was Damon that should have moved out of the way and let him through, but Damon was with Williams, so Prost was leading the race, so he should have done, but I guess in them days they weren't so strict on blue flags and things like that.
And Jordan that year, and around that time as well, were in pretty difficult financial difficulties as well, but it seemed to pick up in 94, and you didn't have a half bad season. You also did some sports car racing for Toyota that year.
Well, EJ was on the up. EJ was really focused at that stage. He was wheeling and dealing, and, you know, he was hungry as hell. He really was hungry as hell, and that's why he got where he got to. You know, the team was seen as a team going places. EJ had the golden touch, and you had Gary Anderson there who could do things for a third of the price that anyone else could do. It was a young team that seemed to be going the right direction. After a year, I realized it wasn't, you know, I realized that these other guys are so far ahead and that next step is enormous. And I realized I had to get out. But I did the sports car thing in Le Mans, which was fantastic. I had so much fun there. I really enjoyed it. I don't remember anything about the 94 season, to be honest. I just remember Le Mans being wonderful.
And what about your relationship with Eddie Jordan? I mean, he's a wheeler dealer. You're obviously a wheeler dealer as well. Did your two relationships spark off each other? How well did you work together?
EJ uses people as I use people. You know, when you're in that, when you're in the game of Formula One, you know, you can be loyal to a certain extent, but really you got to look after number one, because if you don't, you'll get screwed. And EJ, you know, tried to screw me, and I tried to screw him, and you know, that's the way it was. And I think he got $4 million from Ferrari, but he wanted more, and I think he was being greedy, and he didn't get it.
And what about that move to Ferrari? How did that come about? I mean, where did the initial suspicion from your point of view come from that Ferrari want to come knocking?
Well, it wasn't. It was totally my initiative. I spoke with my friends at Marlborough, and I said, what's happening there? And they said, look, go and speak to Jean Todt and see what happens. And he was like, I don't know. But at this stage, I was, you know, I was pretty much the top qualifier of the non-big teams. You know, I was qualifying 7th and 8th. And it was pretty much the big teams that were in front of me. So I was going really well. But he didn't seem that interested. And then Tom Walkinshaw came to me and says, right, how much is it to get you out of your contract? And I told him, it's like, it's $5 million. I'm meant to get $1 million backhander off EJ, but I don't want it. Just get me out of here. He said, okay, come down to my house and we'll sign the contract. And I said, well, it's not too, I'll come down and meet you, but I'm not signing nothing. So I went down and met him. He put the contract down. Like, he was offering me 10 times what Jordan was offering me. And a 3 or 4 year deal, I can't remember what it was, and like huge numbers considering where I was coming from, Jordan, because EJ wasn't the best payer. But I just seen that Walkinshaw was, he was more serious than EJ, and I thought it's the way for me to go if I can't get the Ferrari. So then I went to Jean Todt and I met Jean Todt and I said, look, I'm going to sign a contract with EJ on Monday, and I just giving you warning that the opportunity's gone on Monday. And this was like on the Thursday. And on the Monday, I signed for Ferrari.
There was an incident I was going to talk about in those couple of years. It was Jordan. And you mentioned the fact that you were qualifying extremely well. Canadian Grand Prix, the second and the third with Barrichello. Mm-hmm. I think it was that race that the tricolour came down behind you at the podium ceremony, and you looked right behind it and put your head in your hands. Did that cause any trouble, any strife for you back at home?
I don't remember looking behind. I definitely didn't put my head in my hands, because I don't care what flag's up there. I really don't. You know, if there's a county down flag, I don't even know if there's one, to be honest. I don't care. The flags mean nothing to me. I know my parents got hate mail at some race. I didn't know whether it was that one or not. I honestly have no recollection. The people that are at this level, they're so low, there's no point even bothering with them.
Rubens Barrichello, what was it like to drive him as a partner in a very individual sport? What was he like?
I think he's a very talented driver. He was very good at setup, He had a very good feel for the car, but he was just a total baby. I had no time for him at all, none whatsoever.
Would you have classed him as a good driver?
Very good driver, very technical, great at setting up the car. And that's probably why Ferrari used him a lot, because Michael is not, but he's a baby. You know, he was just a pain in the arse to drive with, because he just logic did not apply on decisions within the team. It, very Latin thing. I had the same problems with Pedro de la Rosa, you know, just a baby.
In contrast to partnering Michael Schumacher at Ferrari?
Total logic, perfect, no issue. I'm not a Michael Schumacher fan at all. I think he's an amazing driver, but that's it. There's no other actually attractive quality. You know, Senna had passion. He was crazy. He was fast. He looked good. He could talk so eloquently. Michael has no qualities apart from being able to drive a racing car very fast.
The 99 season was the one that perhaps was the biggest one for you in terms of Formula One, where you nearly became world champion. Suggestions perhaps of the British Grand Prix, when Schumacher ploughed into the tyres, that he was under pressure, and the pressure was coming from you, because you'd already won your first Grand Prix in Australia.
Well, that, I don't think that's where the pressure came from. I made it very clear, because Michael did an interview before the British Grand Prix, because people had complained that I'd stayed behind him in Magny-Cours, and I was told to stay behind him. I would prefer to have not have had that situation, but it was the best situation available to me at that time. If I was offered a McLaren drive, I would have gone there in a heartbeat, but I wasn't. And Michael came out with this statement, you know, Eddie has only moved over from me once. And that's correct, in that I've only moved over once because they told me to move over once. there's other times where I actually just let him through because I knew there was no point to hold him up. I just let him go. And then when he said that, I thought, okay, now you don't come past until they radio me. And I made that very clear. So then I make a better start on him at Silverstone, and he's trying to overtake me into Stowe, and I just, there was no way he was coming past, so I just braked until they radioed me. So I just braked as late as I could brake, and he tried to outbrake me, and he locked up, came off the brakes, pushed the brakes again in the rear nipple field, and he went into the barrier.
So then suddenly you're the number one driver on the team. I know you had various different partners that year, the likes of Mika Salo and whatever, but you're heading towards possibly being the world champion that year. Did the team back you up the way they should have?
I didn't see that we could win the world championship because the McLaren was much faster. The day that Michael crashed, they took the 99 car out of the wind tunnel and put the 2000 car in the wind tunnel. So they started to develop for next year because they thought, which rightly so, it was a logical decision that this championship's over. Let's go for next year's championship, which I would have done if I was the boss of Ferrari. The problem was we actually ended up doing better than we should have done. McLaren screwed up. We got a few results that we shouldn't have done. And not until probably four races later, did the 99 car go back in the wind tunnel. That's what really cost us the championship. They backed me up 100%. We went testing all the time, but we had nothing to test. You know, we just went testing. Wishbone, you know, we'd be testing roll bars and springs. These don't make the car go faster. You know, it's aero that makes the car go faster. So it was kind of like for show.
So when you actually got to the final round of Japan, where you had to beat Hakkinen, you didn't think it was possible that day, did you?
I thought it was no problem because I'd beat him in Malaysia. No, I would have qualified him by 4 or 5 tenths. I thought, this is easy. This is my best circuit. It's easy. I drove out the pit lane and I was like driving on ice. And I came straight back in. I said, my God, there's something seriously wrong here. I'm driving on ice. We checked everything in the car. And I just, that weekend, there was no grip. I was lapping 2 seconds a lap slower than Michael Schumacher. I couldn't have driven it faster. I crashed in qualifying trying to get within a second and a half off him. There was just no grip.
And then Schumacher comes back and your career with Ferrari kind of peters out and it's Jaguar comes calling with quite a lot of money.
Yeah, financially it was okay. I was offered some very, very similar money elsewhere. But I thought the Jaguar opportunity was much better because Ford said they were going to get stuck in and do it properly.
Did they?
Didn't.
And it came to an end then in 2002. I mean, was there offers out there? I know there was talk about perhaps going back to Jordan, but did you consider any of them seriously?
The only thing I was interested in was going to Jordan for 1 year just to finish it off nicely. Beautiful story, but Ford sort of said to Jordan if they hired me, they'd pull the $2 million subsidy they were getting for the Ford engine, some bullshit like this. Because the last thing they wanted was a Jordan in front of a Jaguar.
When you quit in 2002, did you think to yourself that perhaps I should go back or maybe I'm just not going to look back at all and move on?
I had a great career. I had an amazing life. I'm having a more amazing life now than I was having then because I've got more time to do the things I want to do.
Formula One, though, has got pretty cold. And with now that Jordan's gone, that you're gone, a lot of the characters in the sports, Senna, are long gone. Is it too cold?
Well, I don't think so. I think there's personalities there, but I think the people in charge of Formula One are wrong. And I don't mean Bernie. I mean the suits that run the motor companies. They're trying to sell cars to the family man. They think the family man wants to see the family image. And I don't think the family man does. I think the family man wants to see something that he can't ever get to. It's a dream. You go to the movies to escape. I think you go to a Formula One car to see something that is totally unachievable. I think Raikkonen is a lunatic. Ron Dennis is like trying to hush it up and, you know, and I think it's fantastic what he does. You know, this guy can drive like that and behave like that. It's fantastic.
Overall, your business dealings, I mean, did you start moving into the property ladder, like you mentioned, and all the bar like you have here, Cocoon? Did you start to build this while you were a Formula One driver?
Yeah, I bought my first property in Ireland for £7,000. I've always been looking at what's going to happen after, always have been. You know, I've made my money. I'm happy just having a great time and having businesses that I enjoy. You know, I was offered great opportunities in Macau, you know, where the property are like doubling and tripling every year because it's the Las Vegas of China, but I'm not interested in being there, so I don't want to do that. My most important thing for me is my lifestyle, and if I can make money and have a nice lifestyle, that's what I'll do. I'm not going to compromise my lifestyle to make money.
Now, you mentioned earlier on about that young drivers perhaps should keep that stepladder going or going from Formula Ford, Formula 3, etc. into Formula 1. Would you be interested now sponsoring perhaps a couple of young drivers yourself and bringing them through that way?
I will. when I see the person that I think can be the Michael Schumacher, the Ayrton Senna, I'm not really interested in sponsoring someone who's slightly below that level. And I haven't got the time to go to Formula races. It just doesn't appeal to me at the minute. I'm having much more fun doing property in Miami and here, and you know, I just opened a go-kart centre in Northern Ireland with like football pitches, and I'm really enjoying them businesses because I come in and I can make a little bit of difference.
Perhaps with this new karting track, you might actually spot somebody there.
I do go there and I watch kids driving. None of them, I have to say, I've seen so far, look like they really know what they're doing. And I've never really watched go-karting, I don't know how Raikkonen was on his first four laps, you know. So, and that's the stage these kids are at. So that's something I would be interested in doing maybe in a few years when I kind of understand my path.
And if you could pick out one moment of your Formula One career, what would it be as the highlight?
The most beautiful thing was on the podium in Monza, my last podium, where the whole crowd invaded the track and they, you know, they weren't chanting Michael, they were chanting Eddie. And it was Michael won, Rubens was second, and I was on the podium in third. That was amazing, I have to say. I was so close to retiring straight after that race. I was on the TV getting interviewed and I was just about to say it and I thought, just wait, you never know. And I probably should have done then, but, you know, no one times anything perfectly.
Eddie Irvine, thank you very much.
Thank you.